I'm Gillian Creasy. I'm a local councillor here in Sheffield, and I've been invited to chair the meeting because I've been connected with the Sheffield Guantanamo campaign for a number of years. So it's a huge privilege for me to welcome our speakers, Wazan Beg, Chris Arendt and Omar Dagaz, to Sheffield. And it's a privilege for me to welcome so many people to a meeting here at the Grosvenor Hotel tonight. I think most of you will have seen posters, so you'll know what it's about and why we're here. But just to clarify that, this is part of a tour that's been organised by Cage Prisoners, which supports anyone who has been imprisoned all over the world. But it's been hosted in Sheffield by the Sheffield Guantanamo campaign, Stop the War, and then I must get these names right. There are two university groups, the group from Sheffield Hallam, the Islamic Society, and Stop Islamophobia, which is a society in Sheffield University. So thank you very much to all those four groups for having got together and put this event on. In terms of the order of the meeting, what we're going to do is that Wazan Beg is going to read a poem by Sami Hadj. On your leaflets, Sami was supposed to be one of the speakers, but I think he's not able to be here with visa problems, so he isn't here. So Wazan's going to pay respects to him by reading one of his poems. We're then going to have a talk from Omar, who was out of Guantanamo for just over a year. It's kind of amazingly exciting for me to meet Omar, because there was a meeting in Sheffield 18 months, 2 years ago, with his brother here, campaigning on his behalf. So it is very, very exciting to have the man here. Wonderful. And then after that, we'll have Chris and Wazam in dialogue, I think, is how they're going to do their presentation. Then we're going to have questions. I'm sure you'll all have lots of things that you want to ask, and I will chair that as best I can. And then we're going to round up with Wazan saying a bit about Cage Prisoners and inviting you to read and respond to these pledges, and then a collection on the way out. I just want to finish with kind of one thought, really, which is the last time Wazan was in Sheffield was to speak at St. Peter's Hall, I think, in Netheredge. And you were on the platform with Mushir Farah from the Sheffield Palestinian Solidarity Campaign. And it would just feel strange not to refer to what's happening in Gaza at the moment. And what I remember from that meeting is how powerful it was to have two people talking about individuals that they knew, that themselves and others that they knew, who had their human rights taken away from them in the most horrific way. And it made me realise that by focusing on very individual human rights and really in respecting individual people, that we respect peoples and the whole of humanity. And that I never really felt that message so strongly as at that meeting. And I'm really looking forward to the messages that come out from tonight. Thank you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, most compassionate, most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Sami, of course, as you have heard, was not able to make it. But one of the reasons he wasn't able to make it, despite the denial of or not receiving his visa in time, is that he's, in the first instance, actually attempted to go to Gaza on a ship aptly named the Dignity, which was struck by an Israeli gunboat and rammed, so he couldn't make it to Gaza before he was trying to come to the UK. Since just today, I've been contacted with him by him again, and he's not been able to get his visa in time to come to the UK. But again, he is making an attempt to go to Gaza. So this man who served as a detainee in Guantanamo Bay for 6 years plus, despite all of the horrors that he endured, has, within months of his return, continued to do the job that took him into detention in the first place, and that is to report about the truth of what's taking place. This is quite commendable. It's amazing that he's doing this. He's not required to do so. There's many other people who could have done it, but he still feels the passion for campaigning for people who are oppressed around the world. And Sami wrote this poem. Sami wrote this poem in Guantanamo Bay whilst he was there as a detainee. And it's called Humiliated in the Shackles. When I heard pigeons cooing in the trees, hot tears covered my face. When the lark chirped, my thoughts composed a message for my son. Muhammad, I am afflicted. In my despair, I have no one but Allah for comfort. The oppressors are playing with me as they move freely about the world. They ask me to spy on my countrymen, claiming that it would be a good deed. They offer me money and land and freedom to go wherever I please. Their temptations seize my attention like lightning in the sky. But their gift is an evil snake, carrying hypocrisy in its mouth like venom. They have monuments to liberty and a freedom of expression, which is all well and good. But I explain to them that architecture is not justice. America, you ride on the backs of orphans and terrorize them daily. Bush, beware. The world recognizes an arrogant liar. To Allah I direct my grievance and my tears. I am homesick and oppressed. Muhammad, do not forget me. Support the cause of your father, a God-fearing man. I was humiliated in the shackles. How can I now compose verses? How can I now write? After the shackles and the nights and the suffering and the tears, how can I write poetry? My soul is like a rolling sea, stirred by anguish, violent with passion. I am a captive, but the crimes are my captors. I am overwhelmed with apprehension. Lord, unite me with my son Muhammad. Lord, grant success to the righteous. Sami was ultimately reunited with his son last year, Muhammad, who was nearly 7 years old by the time he saw him. And the last time he'd seen him, of course, was just as a child. Sami was not able to make it, but last week there was another former Guantanamo detainee who'd served 6 years and 8 months in Guantanamo without charge or trial from Qatar. And he toured with myself and Chris around the country. And one of the things that both myself and Chris and everybody else thought about this man, Jarullah Al-Marri, was that despite him having been detained there for so long, many times in his broken English with an American accent that he'd learnt in Guantanamo, he'd get up and say, listen people, I'm here to talk about the campaign for my brother who's detained without charge and without trial in the United States of America and about my Guantanamo experience, but how can I do so when I see Gaza bombed and decimated in the way that it is? How can I talk to you about torture? How can I talk to you about cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment at a time when people's lives are being destroyed? How can I talk to you about all of this? So sometimes he said that and he just sat down and he didn't talk about his campaign anymore. And this was a man who'd been in prison in Guantanamo for nearly 7 years. So this is again a testimony to the types of people that have come out from there who feel with passion, even despite the oppression that they faced. They continue to campaign for what is right and what is true. I'll pass you over now to Omar.
First, I would like first to thank you for having us, having me here in your hospitality in Sheffield. It's been a very nice city, and thank you very much. And also, I would like to thank all those people who worked hard in helping and gaining our release from Guantanamo, and continue to work hard to close down that awful place, Guantanamo Bay, and other places. I would like today to speak to you about how it feels to be from the other side of the barbed wire, from the inside of the barbed wire, not to gain your sympathy and feel sorry for us or for me, but rather to be positive and to have the constructive sympathy which will lead you to do more work than you have done already, which you have done a lot, and more work to gain the release of other many people still are locked up in Guantanamo and other places. I would like to remind you of the hardship and the awful place that Guantanamo stands for. And so, as I say, an incentive, or it might motivate you more, as I'm sure it would, as humans, to do more work and more hard efforts to release other people who are still locked up in Guantanamo. waking up in Guantanamo Bay is an awful thing. One of the most things that you might think of every morning when you wake up is the possibility of being murdered, killed. Because there have been people who have been killed. I witnessed four in Guantanamo. Muazzam have witnessed others in Bagram. And another Afghani friend of mine witnessed other people being killed in another place, not in Guantanamo, in another prison where he was under an American prison before he got to Guantanamo. According to Thomas Friedman, a New York Times writer, he says, this was in 2005, an article I read, he says that more than 100 prisoners have died in detention centers throughout under the United States control. And they all claim the United States, he's saying in the New York Times article, he's saying they all have been claimed that they have died through a heart attack. He says this is not only politically wrong, but it is a grave, it's grave immorality, it's immoral, gravely immoral. To be in Guantanamo, to wake up in Guantanamo, you wake up to the possibility of being amputated. There are some people, friends of ours, who had injuries. They were not treated for their injuries, but rather amputated. Like Alanezi, who lost both of his feet. They amputated both of his foot. Now he walks without both of his feet, where his foot were amputated. Like Imran al-Taifi, who his leg was, he needed just a surgical operation. They amputated his leg. Like Abu Abdurrahman al-Masri, where the need for the amputation was from here, because he was injured down here. They amputated his leg from here, so he cannot use his leg anymore, more so than if it was amputated from here. The waking up or being in Guantanamo, you are exposed to sexual harassment, sexual abuse. There were people in Bagram, four people in Bagram, where they were entered into a tent and their hands were chained to a bar in the tent, and all of them were sexually abused in front of each other. Another man in the dark prisons of Kabul, an African man, with the same act happened to him again, and then they released him saying that he was innocent and that he was a brave man. The possibility, waking up in Guantanamo, there is a possibility you being exposed to your eyes being gouged out, like prisoner 727, and the other people like Irshad, the Pakistani, and like the Algerian man who lost his eye because they threw him to the ground and his eye hit some stone and he lost his eye. The living in Guantanamo, you are exposed to the toilets being overflow of the toilets inside your cell and living under those conditions. The use of medical drugs and the use of medical treatment to make you speak more in interrogation and so on. Floodlights, 24 hours of floodlights. You live under 6 years of a small cell. You'll be under a big, large floodlights in those small cells for 24 hours, exposed to those lights. Can't sleep day or night. You are to be searched twice a day sometimes. And so on. Food, sometimes dirty food, scorpions and foods, like what happened to Jum'a al-Dusari and what happened to Hisham al-Sliti, and many, many other things that do occur in those cruel places. You're reduced to numbers, you're shackled. There is no rules or laws, but other than the guards' laws and rules, not even as a high-ranking officers, but guards make the rules and really interrogators as they wish and whims of the interrogators, because everything in Guantanamo is geared for interrogation and to expose or to extract more information. Therefore, as you will see, it is obviously a bad place. And I'm sure all of human beings and all of you understand and sympathize that those places should be brought down and shut down. But the problems, Guantanamo, Obama said he might shut down this place, and there's a likelihood that this place might shut down. But there are many other places like Guantanamo. There are many other places even worse than Guantanamo Bay and run by the Americans. But Guantanamo Bay has become notorious because many people have spoken about how bad it is and the hardship that goes on inside those places. There are places in Morocco which are run by the Americans, but they are in Moroccan souls and bases. Like Binyam, when he was taken to Morocco there, and he was exposed that to his private part, they had some razors drawn to his private parts. There are another camp in Jordan where there are about 10 people, and they're very highly security. They're called the Jordan Jafar camp, which is run by the Americans, and also the guards there are Americans, but no one can enter to that place. There's about 10 detainees, was reported in American newspapers. And there are 10 detainees where they are faced with all sorts of torture, which is worse than what goes on in Guantanamo. In Kabul, the dark prisons of Kabul, in Kosovo, in Romania, in Poland, in Egypt, like the story that many of you know about Abdulaziz Al-Fakhri, the man who was transferred to Egypt in a box. And then he was tortured in Egypt to say things that weren't true. He said, because of the torture, he admitted to things that weren't the case. And because of what he said about Saddam Hussein being in relationship with the Qaeda, the Americans went to war. And they basing their claims on the claims or on the things that Al-Fakhri have said into interrogation. Many others in Libya and other countries that are run for the American government, Bush's government, Garcia, as I say, many other prisons. Those prisons obviously are a bad thing that they should carry on. That those prisons are as bad as Guantanamo, if not worse, because we remember when we were in Bagram, it was worse than Guantanamo Bay. The torture there is more awful than Guantanamo Bay. And I would like the people, and people like yourselves, not to forget that, to continue campaigning even if Guantanamo Bay was closed. Though I have my doubts, because those politicians have said that Guantanamo Bay would be closed soon. Even when the Bush administration was ruling, they said they would close Guantanamo Bay, but they didn't. They said that 3 times. Obama have said the same thing, promised the same thing, and now, for now, he has, every time we hear different clashing statements. Sometimes he wants to close it, sometimes he doesn't. So even if those places were closed, I would like to remind you about all the other places where there are more hardship and more torture goes on in those places. And when those places close down, there is another problem with the handing, even in Guantanamo. If Guantanamo closes down, there are other people who are still left in Guantanamo, about 40 detainees in Guantanamo. There is a very serious threat for their lives if they were returned to their countries. In Guantanamo, there's approximately more than 240 to 300 detainees. But 40 of them, only 40 of them, are endangered. If they were taken back to their countries, they will be certainly killed or tortured. Like, they will be sent to countries like Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan is very well known of, they throw people into boiling water and to chemicals, according to newspaper, American newspapers and Human Watch in America. Countries like China, countries like Egypt, like, as I mentioned, the case of Abdulaziz Al-Fakhri, which is more known as Ibn Sheikh Al-Libi, where he was tortured so badly that he admitted to things that he have not committed. Countries like Tunisia, where there are 10 detainees in Guantanamo, and in their absence, they haven't been charged in Guantanamo. They have never been charged, never have been told of their crime. They have not committed any crime. They have not been charged in Guantanamo, but still the Tunisian government have given them 10 to 40 years, even before they come to Tunisia, in their absence. There are two of them were handed back to Tunis when we were there, and they were tortured badly, so badly that they wished that they were returned to Guantanamo. And the Tunisian government wasn't even embarrassed from the American lawyers who were present and saw everything there. They came there to attend the to attend, to visit, sometimes try to visit, sometimes to the court where they were supposedly, there was a trial taking place. And the Tunisian government wasn't even embarrassed from that publicity. They carried on torturing them, they abused them, they threatened their wives with the rape and things like that. And other things, the other countries like Syria, there are some detainees who are from Syria. There was a case of one man who was released recently in Canada. He was taken, abducted by the Americans, and then handed to the Syrians. I think his name is Maher or something like that. He was handed to the Syrians, and when in Syria, they put him into a grave, literally a real grave. He lived in a grave, not in a cell, but a grave, where he ate and slept and lived. And the Canadian, because he had a Canadian nationality, the Canadian ambassador, I think, or some official from the Canadian embassy, came to visit him every time to speak to him. And this person, from his fear, he could not, he used to ask him, "How are you? How are you doing? Are you good?" All this is published and known in Amnesty reports and other reports. And he used to speak to him, and he never could admit to this man that he was living in a grave. Every time he came to ask him, he said, "How are you doing?" And he said, "I'm well, I'm good." Until one day, he started screaming. He broke down and he started screaming and saying, "What do you ask me about my health? I'm living in a grave." And he told him what was happening to him. And since then, that official went and did some work to get him out, and they released him afterwards with some pressure from Canada, I think, and he's now released in Canada, and he has taken the Americans and the Canadian government, I think, to court, and he's been awarded damages or something. These are some kind of people that the fear that they might be handed to countries that are worse than they might be, as I say, they might be facing conditions. Those 40 people in Guantanamo are in real danger. A danger more than any other danger of other detainees. And if the Guantanamo Bay was to be closed, and people not realizing what is happening in secret, they might be handed back to their countries where they are really would be more tortured, and definitely, if not killed, tortured. So this is something that I would like you to also remember, ladies and gentlemen. And I want to also, at last, to say that there might be a moral persuasion on the governments who've used Guantanamo and collaborated with the government of American government when we were locked up in Guantanamo. Because no one now, the United States is asking other countries to come forward and take those 40 people. Because the majority of people locked up are Yemenis and Saudis. There are 100 Yemenis and 100 Saudis. And they make the majority of the camp. If the Yemenis were to return, everyone wants to return to Yemen. They have no problem. The Saudis have the same thing. They have no problems. They can return. If those 200 were returned to their countries, Guantanamo would virtually be empty. But they will be left, 40 people left, where their lives are in real danger. And Americans have spoken about this. Even the Bush administration, not only Obama, have been asking governments in Europe again and again to come forward and take some of those detainees. They're only 40. The European countries might be even more than 40 in number. Each one could take two or three. Spain offered to take some. Portugal offered to take some. And Qatar also offered to take some, but only on the condition if all other countries have taken other detainees back. Because everyone is frightened if he takes detainees back unilaterally, he will be accused of being a supporter of terrorism and so on. So I think there is a moral duty. Maybe there is a moral duty, because when we were locked up in Guantanamo, there are many delegations or many security services used to come there and use the base and use to interrogate people there. The British Intelligence Service, the MI5 and MI6, like Mazen will tell you, I will tell you, they were the people who brought the false allegations about Chechnya, about me. This is the first time the Americans heard anything about Chechnya was through the MI5 and MI6 when they came to visit us there. They were the people who brought the Spanish allegation, which prolonged my staying there to more than 6 years. When I was first locked up in Guantanamo, the Americans said, "We have nothing about, we don't know who you are. We don't even know your name, nor where your address. And we're waiting for the files to come through." And the files did come through. They told them where I lived, the university, where I went. And they tried to make up something of nothing, just to please the Americans, to try to show them they are cooperating with them in this war against terror. And they realize, that's why there is a case now brought even against the MI5 and against the people who collaborated, as Muazzam will tell you, and he knows. Because not to retribute, not to revenge, but to stop them from doing so again to any other person. So there are the Italian delegates that used to come there, the Italian security service used to come and used to interrogate people who lived in Italy. The Spanish came there, the Spanish security service came and saw. The British used to interrogate me while in Bagram. I used to tell them, just look down. Just look at this concentration camp. Look at those sick people there. Look at the awful place, how it looks. Look at this. I was nearly 40 days without food, without water, and without food. And they can see my condition, and they still interrogated, and they look. And not that they didn't know what was going on, but I remember telling them, just look down, look. The Italian, as I say, the Spanish, I remember the Spanish delegate asked Radwan, a Moroccan who lived for a while in Spain and married to a Spanish woman. They interrogated him and they offered him an offer. They said, we will take now. They took off his chains and gave him a telephone to call his family. They said, speak to your family in Morocco. And he did. He spoke to his family. And they said to him, we will release you now. They brought him food. We will release you now, but on only one condition, that you become a witness against... You remember there was a Spanish, big Spanish case against terrorism, against a group of people. They said it was the biggest European case against terror. I think it was 2 years ago when I was in prison there. They came before that, they came to this person. They said to him, we want you to be a witness in this case. He said, but I don't know any of these people. He said, that's not a problem. That's not a problem. We will tell you who to... We will put you behind screens and we will tell you who to say yes, I know, and who you say no, I don't, and things like that. They will tell. So he refused to do that. And they said, we'll offer you a house. It's a funny thing. They said, we'll offer you a house and a car and so on. But he looked at the intelligent guy, and said, you will offer me a house. Look at your shoes. You don't even have a proper shoes to offer me a house. So things like that. So there are many other delegates, like, as I say, the Libyan, the Egyptians, for example. Leave the Libyans. They were one of the worst intelligence services who came there. But the Egyptians, when the Egyptians came there, there was a man called Abdul Aziz. He's a doctor in university in Kabul. An Egyptian man who's a doctor in University of Kabul. He was locked up in those camps. I know him very well because I was the person who put him through to some lawyers because I knew his conditions was very much in danger if he was returned to Egypt. This person, when the Egyptians came to Guantanamo, they asked, his back was broken, he's paralyzed because his back was broken by the earth team. There are some guards in the camp. They broke his back while he was in hospital. So he was very paralyzed and he was going in a wheelchair because they paralyzed him. So he couldn't walk, he couldn't do anything because his spine was broken. So they came very late at night, like 3 o'clock at night, and they asked to bring him in this condition to the interrogation room where the Egyptians were to interrogate him, and the Americans were sitting to watch the intelligence. Other American intelligence were watching this interrogation. So he wasn't able to walk, so they brought him into stretchers. And they put him, the Egyptian intelligence saw his bad conditions and very late at night, like 3 o'clock at night. And they said to them, take him out from his stretchers, tie him down in the chair, and let him sit down and speak. So they took him out, the Americans took him out from his chair. Now this is in Cuba, now leave alone when he goes back to Egypt. This is how their treatment is in front of people, and they're not embarrassed not to be exposed. They took him out from those stretchers, they put him on the chair, and he started speaking to him, where he refused to answer any questions. He was very tired and sick, and he's a very old man. So he fell out from his chair. When he fell out from his chair, they said to the guards, pick him up from the floor, put him back in the chair, and chain him this time in the chair. And they were making all sorts of accusations and threats to him. And if he doesn't speak now, he will be speaking when he gets to Egypt, because they know how the way they will make him speak, and so on. The same with the Libyan delegates, where they threatened and said all sorts of things to people. Lastly, ending all this, I speak about these things and mention these stories and how those people acted in the Guantanamo Bay. They were not frightened of being exposed. They are not frightened. They are worse. Those people are even worse than the U.S. guards in Guantanamo conditions. There are conditions in these countries are even worse. Guantanamo is a bad place. It's not justified. The existence of Guantanamo, but there are other places who are worse than Guantanamo, not only in these countries, but even places where they are run by the American administration. So, my friends and ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask you and remind you that your campaigning and you writing to your MPs and writing to your MEPs to influence them and tell them about these things and accepting to give those people asylum in those countries or whichever country, because the Americans, the United States, do not want them anymore. And they do not know where to send them. They do not want to keep them, and they don't have an idea how to get rid of them. And only those who are under this hardship, under this lock and hardship, are those who are prisoners there. So your work, your hard work, and your campaigning, and your awareness is very important to continue the good work you have already done. And I want to say again at the end, I want to thank you very much, and I want to expose or say how much grateful I am, and many members of my family who have come here and spoken to you before, they send their gratefulness and thankfulness to all of you. Thank you very much.
Just one point before, 2 points before we start. One is that Omar spoke about the detention camps that exist around the world that make Guantanamo Bay look relatively tame. One of those is Bagram, the detention facility where I was held and many others were held. And there's a film called Taxi to the Dark Side. It won the Oscar for best film last year because I'm in it. No, sorry. But it did win the Oscar for last year for the best documentary. So it is available there at the back. I urge you to see it. It is one of a kind, and it describes in detail what we had to go through before we ever went to Guantanamo. And the second thing is, I don't know if you noticed this, but Omar Dagayas actually mentioned that some people had their eyes gouged out. And he mentioned prisoner 727. Well, he was 727. Chris, you've toured with me around the country. We've spoken at more places than we can remember. We have seen audiences of all varieties and backgrounds and races and religions and creeds and so forth and ages. What's your perception of coming to the UK and seeing this after you began your campaign of speaking out against what you saw in Guantanamo?
They're relatively similar. I mean, I don't feel like I'm really that far from home. I mean, I remember every time I drive and I get freaked out because you guys drive like crazy people over here. But yeah, for the most part, I mean, same newspapers outside. The audiences are, other than the influx of, we've seen a lot more Muslims in the audiences than I've ever seen in America. I think that in the political activist scene, they've been kind of afraid to come out of the woodworks because they were just so heavily persecuted after 9/11, and they really still haven't started to come out. So,
one of the things that struck me about you when I first met you and first saw you, and that was just over a week and a half ago after you'd been detained at the airport about 7 hours before coming into the UK, was your age. I realized before that you were young, but how old were you when you decided to join the army, and what motivated you to do so?
I was 17 years old. I was coming out of, like most of the people in the military, I was coming out of some pretty impoverished circumstances. At the time, My family was split up and all over Michigan. My mom was living in a hotel about 60 miles away from the school I went to, the town I went to school in, and I was staying with some friends. So, I was a senior in high school. It was the first semester of senior year. And I just didn't really see much of a future for me, and I didn't see much of a future for me in Michigan. So, I decided to join the military and try to get some college money. I mean, that was a big push as well. I mean, they come hollering with their, you know, like with their college money, you know, free 100% tuition coverage, like, which is basically like, hey, all you poor people, come on, the trailer park, join the military, get your college money. So I got suckered in.
And so, at the age of 17, you joined the National Guard. That's the equivalent of our territorial army over here. You're weekend warriors. You're not the real deal, are you?
No.
You're not the real deal, but you trained in artillery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you trained in using these
155 millimeter cannons.
Right, okay. But you're not the real deal.
No.
Imagine if you were then. But what happened then? What was the point? I mean, a lot of people are confused. They think, surely people who went to Guantanamo Bay or go to Iraq or go to Afghanistan actually wanted to go there. And they're sort of gung-ho, and they joined after September 11th, and they wanted to, as they say, you know, kick some butt. Is that what motivated you to go to Guantanamo?
Well, I mean, technically the only thing that motivated me to go to Guantanamo was that I'd go to jail if I didn't go to Guantanamo. So, but no, that certainly wasn't, those were not my motivations in the military. I mean, I was highly motivated to... not go anywhere, really. That's why I joined the National Guard. I mean, like, I got kind of fooled. I figured that word "national" and "guard" put together meant that I'd be staying within, you know, the nation. But that didn't work out.
So, at what point did you come to the realization that the National Guard has now been activated? I believe the first time in the history of the National Guard. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, some units had been activated before, but for domestic things, and a few National Guard units have made it into, like, World War II. A couple National Guard units went, but those were voluntary. Those people were in the National Guard and then voluntarily joined active service from their units to go to World War II, and also some in Vietnam. But this is the first time that it was a federal mandate that National Guard serve.
So you had been trained as an artilleryman, how to put sort of shells into tanks and into artillery pieces and to fire them across vast tracts of whatever it is. How did that change to becoming a military policeman guarding people in Guantanamo?
Well, it changed in about a week over our reclassification period. I mean, normally in reclassification, if you want to change your MOS from anything to another, military occupational specialty. Sorry, I've got the
acronym.
Yeah, it takes about 2 to 4 weeks at least, at bare minimum, to change from one MOS to another. But we were switched from working with cannons to working with detainees. In about a 1 week long training process.
Working with cannons and then working with shackles.
Yeah.
And then what was your perception about Guantanamo before they sent you there? What sort of briefing did they give you about us as detainees? Well, how did they explain to you the kinds of people we were?
They made sure that we all knew that you guys were hardened terrorists and baby killers, expert toilet paper knife makers. You would take every opportunity, always, and never skip one, to kill us in cold blood. If we ever, you know, if we talk to you, you'd use that as an advantage to sneak out of your cell and kill everybody in all of Camp Delta.
You mentioned that we were taught in tactics of how to make impromptu weapons. What were you told that we would utilize as a material to make, for example, knives and shanks? What's the type of thing that they said that we would use?
Toilet paper and plastic spoons.
Toilet paper and plastic spoons.
Yeah.
And you actually received toilet paper training?
Oh yeah, we received two days of that 1 week training we got on how to deal with detainees. None of it was actually like how to deal with human beings that are inside of cells. But 2 days of that was getting stabbed with rubber knives and doing like hand to hand combat training before we left, so that we could, you know, while yelling in classic military fashion, I will get stabbed, but I will not die.
Especially if it's a toilet paper knife.
Yeah, especially. Probably won't even bleed.
Then you were on the blocks. I remember one of the emails before I met you and before we exchanged pleasantries. You wrote an email to me saying that, "Mosam, can you understand? I was just a kid when I walked up those blocks. I understand why those people would have hated me." And then you of course, was talking about a time that you'd seen. What were those blocks? What did it mean to you as a young man from Michigan walking the blocks with 24 cells on either side, detaining and guarding men whose language, culture, and customs and origins you had no understanding of? What did that mean to you?
Well, it meant that something had gone horribly wrong. I mean, I'm, you know, 19 years old. My uniform's hung off me like a garbage bag. I mean, my uniform didn't even fit me. It was huge, and I knew that to them I was just this. I was just one. I mean, all you can see in a military uniform is a little face poking up out of this big green outfit. You know, so I knew that they didn't care who I was. They just knew that I was wearing that uniform, that I was part of this thing, and that they had every right to hate me. Because I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't, you know, they knew they were there for the wrong reasons. I was pretty certain they were there for the wrong reasons. But you know, the rest of the guys I was with, like, you know, some of them treated them pretty badly. So to them, I was just another, you know, block guard. So it was a pretty nervous experience because I wanted to, you know, go around apologizing and telling people I'm sorry, but same time, I don't have an apology that's that big. You know, I can't apologize enough for that, and I can't let anybody go, because then you'd just be, you know, that you're five more Sally ports until you get into just camp, you know, Guantanamo Bay, and that, you know, that's a whole other story. So
you'd never met a Muslim before this, and I dare say you said last time, I think, you'd hardly seen any black people, let alone Muslims. What was your perception of people, of Muslim people, prior to Guantanamo, and what was your perception after the deployment?
I mean, before I'd gone to Cuba, I can't even say what my perception was. I didn't have a perception of Muslims. Like, I mean, like most of the people I grew up with, we hadn't met anybody that was Muslim. You know, I grew up in a country town that was mostly just farmers, all exclusively white. We had one black kid move into our school in fifth grade, and their family had to leave because the kids in my class treated them so bad that their whole family just uprooted, sold their house, and left. So, I didn't know anything about it at the time. I didn't know anything about anybody from that culture. And then I went to Cuba and found out that, for the most part, well, I mean, at least the Muslims that are, you know, hardened terrorists were pretty intelligent, all, you know, spoke a lot of different languages, extremely devout people. At the very least, I didn't see them as well, I mean, probably well, way more devout than I'd seen in any religious practice that I'd seen before, you know, because Christians can be a little dodgy about some rules and practices. So, you know, like after I went to Cuba, I you know, just mostly just respect for the culture.
And you and I both have said that speaking about the experiences of the dehumanization, the humiliation, the demonization that we experience as detainees is not necessarily good for our own souls, not good for our own psychological state of mind, yet it's important to get some of this out. But just before I say that, I remember an American soldier once said to me that he felt like he was in a bigger prison than us, and that we were both imprisoned in a way or another, although he never equated the imprisonment in any way. But he said that to keep a man down, you have to stay with him. And that reminded me almost of a judo, jiu-jitsu style hold, that when you put somebody down, you put them in a submission position, they'll only remain there as long as you're there with them. And the moment they stand up, you stand up too. But there was a process, there were many processes that you were involved with, that you saw or witnessed, that come under the concept of torture and cruel and inhuman degrading treatment. What in your mind was pushing people to behave like this? Was it the standard operating procedure? Was it the fact that President Bush and Dick Cheney and others had said that these people are terrorists, therefore they must be treated in this way? Or was it the individual responsibility of guards who came across and did what they did that made them act in that way?
I was thinking last night, and I think I finally got what you meant. I've been thinking about it, and I was too ashamed to admit it, but I didn't really get what you meant, like the metaphor of staying down with them. And I finally understood what that means, that we had to be kind of essentially had to drag ourselves down and be these kind of hideous, awful renditions of ourselves while we were down there, to ensure that we were making your lives hideous and awful as well. Or at least I think that's what you meant by it. To answer your question, it really comes from all the different... I would say almost everything you said is true. I think that President Bush's and the administration, the right wing, and just the you know, generic bigotry implanted in America was utilized against you and us as well, to tell us that to basically dehumanize you in the same way that we dehumanized the Native Americans and the African Americans of America, to turn the entire class of Muslims, Middle Eastern people into animals, and to be worth nothing. We had a standard operating procedure, which was a book of rules that allowed us to... It gave us a cap on what kind of violence we could use, but that cap was pretty lofty, so it set as a bare minimum of ethical behavior, a pretty, in my mind, pretty horrendously high cap. And we also, we also came with this stuff ourselves. We also came with all of our ignorance and bigotry into a place, into a culture, and into a highly tense environment, away from a lot of the things we know and love. And we came with all the resentment and the anger that you would find in any repressed economic class. Because, like I said, the United States military isn't composed of the elite and wealthy. That's composed of poor people, and the poor people have their hang-ups. Poor people have can have anger issues and can have resentment, and I think we brought that with us, and we used those things also took part in why things were so particularly violent down there.
At the time when you saw people being punched in the face or kicked in the face, dragged across the floor, being sprayed with pepper spray in their faces, a whole can being emptied in their faces sometimes, or these instant reaction force teams, which were heavily suited up men in riot gear, storming into a cell, smashing people down to the ground. What did you feel when you saw all of this?
Well, I felt like we can't possibly take anything more from you guys. I mean, you're already down in Guantanamo. You got a prayer mat, you got a sheet, you got, maximum, what did the deodorant say?
Maximum security.
Yeah, deodorant. Maximum security deodorant. You got a little 1-inch toothbrush. I mean, there wasn't any more we could take from you, like, Guantanamo, first and foremost, above all physical abuse, is a psychologically abusive environment. That's the tool that they use as an interrogation technique, is to keep you in this just legalistic black hole that you have no hope. You're strangled from all society. You're strangled from anything except for the guards and your fellow detainees, and even then you're strangled from them because you can't talk on the blocks. I mean, even before that, I figured, what else could we possibly take from you guys? And then I found out what that was. I mean, we could we can beat you. We can take from you at least physical comfort. And it made me feel like, it made me feel pretty ashamed of the uniform. It made me feel ashamed of the people I'd come there with, and it made me feel sorry for the detainees. It made me feel sorry for the people that were doing it, because they were doing things that they're never going to be able to take back. And whether or not they want to admit that those things were wrong, those things were wrong, period. I think that that's an objective, universal line that they've crossed, and I think that they've crossed a line that they're going to have to deal with for the rest of their lives. So I pity them that they took that opportunity, and it makes me feel sick that these people you guys are gonna have to live with these abuses for the rest of your lives in your head. The guards are gonna have to live in the abuses with the abuses in the lives in the head, in their head, and they were just using us against each other the whole time. I mean, we weren't as guards. We were being used by our government and corporations, and we were being used by our leadership, and you guys were being used as well in the same way. So in a sense we were basically caught in the same cage. My friend from the Iraq Veterans Against the War said the same thing to a lot of the detainees he worked in. You small cage, me bigger cage, and that horrendous,
they answered back in perfect English.
More than likely. If not, he'd just say it louder again and again and again
until
he's just yelling the same thing over and over again. You know how we do our translations.
The louder you are, the more you're understood. There's what you've just referred to about people perhaps feeling, having some empathy towards the concept of those people, the people oppressing one another, and feeling pity towards them. There's a verse in the Quran, or there's a mention in the Quran that says, "وَمَا ظَلَمُونَا وَلَكِن كَانُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ يَظْلِمُونَ," that we didn't oppress them, but they oppressed themselves. And the oppression of the self is often, when you oppress somebody else, you're also oppressing yourself. And one of the things that I noticed was that when you came to the UK, you met with many of the Guantanamo detainees. You met Omar before, and you met some of the others, and we all had dinner together. Could you have ever envisaged this at all, when you were in the midst of the height of your time in Guantanamo as a military policeman? Could you have ever envisaged sitting at the Maida Grill restaurant, or any restaurant, in the middle of East London, sitting talking to these detainees who President Bush had said are amongst the worst and most dangerous terrorists on earth, including me?
If I would have ever turned around to another guard and said, "You know what I'm going to do when I get out of the military? I'm going to find these guys again, and I'm going to go out to dinner with them." I probably would have gotten my ass whooped.
and of course, they must have thought, and somebody must have thought along the line, that you meeting these detainees would have got your ass whooped by the detainees too. But that wasn't the case. We almost fed you to death.
I think that's been my greatest danger, is that I'm going to die of actually being properly nutritioned for the first time.
With Arabic and Asian food.
I can't take any more spices.
One of the things that people don't often realize, and it's a necessity, it's a consequence, a necessary consequence of any detention process, guard-prisoner relationships. What was your relationship with many of the, or any of the detainees that you came across? You must have come across some of them who you'd heard of them before, like people called the professor or the general and so forth. You must have heard of them. But what was your perception after interaction with some of the detainees then?
Every detainee is different. Like, I got to clear something right now. Like, the word detainee just freaks me out, and it's freaked me out the whole time we've been using it. They pushed us so hard. Like, this is how feeble the whole buildup is. It's not, you've got to call people in Guantanamo detainees. The whole thing is built on such a feeble rhetorical structure that if you say prisoner, it all collapses because it becomes subject to an entirely new set of laws.
Because that, prisoners have rights.
Yeah, prisoners have rights. Detainees, however, are this just gigantic loophole, so you have to call them detainees. I'm so trained to calling people that were there detainees and not prisoners or just people I don't know. Sorry.
Sad because I also call them detainees.
Yeah, it's stuck in. Like they push it so hard. You know, you're not allowed to call it a prison camp. You're not allowed to call them prisoners because it's that thin a line that we're treading with this rhetoric that it's all in what we call it that makes it even possible. And I think that's just craziness. You know, like I mean, just changing you can't find a difference between, like, if you look at a dictionary and throw it on what a detainee and what a prisoner is, you're not going to be able to find any. You know, I mean, it's so ridiculously thin. But sorry, to get back to your question, I just realized that word has been freaking me out this whole time. What was your question again?
I don't know. it was your interaction in relation to the detainees after in relation to the prisoners.
Oh yeah.
What did you feel once you'd met and spoke with them and interacted with them as real people?
Well, all the real famous ones. Like, the only time I ever met the professor, he was in isolation, and the only thing I remember was that he was angry. Like, he was upset that day for sure. So the only time I ever met the professor, he was not as talkative as I'd heard he was. I never got a chance to meet, you know, there's like the famous detainees down there.
Prisoners,
sorry. Captives. They're different. Everybody's different down there. You know, there's Triple Nickel, who's probably one of the weirdest cases of people I've ever met in my life. Every time we met him, it was like when we go pick him up in Camp 4, it was like we were going to pick him up to go out to the movies or something. He was all like, "Hey, what's up, guys? How are you guys doing? Like, you know, how's everything going?"
And this guy was an Iranian drug dealer.
Yeah. because we're now apparently the global DEA as well in picking up drug dealers.
Well, like, you did have the war on drugs, didn't you?
Yeah. We've got lots of wars. I can't even keep track of all the wars we got going on.
The prisoner referred to as the professor, of course, is, for those of you who don't know, is Shakir Ahmed. You can see some postcards of him at the back. He's a British resident. His wife and children are all British. His youngest son was born just after my own son was born, and he's never seen him in his entire life. So he has a 7-year-old British son in London who doesn't know what it is to have a father. What does that make you think about this whole predicament that people are in?
I mean, it's probably the words of my mom that ring best. I've never had a kid, so I don't really understand fully how much that would drive me crazy, but I think about how just totally nuts my mom is about me. And if she'd missed my life until I was 7 years old and then was just dropped, all I hear about every time I see that woman is, you know, "Oh, when you were 2, when you were 3, when you were 4, when you were 5, if she was stripped of all those memories and then just deposited back into my life, I think she'd be a broken mess. You know, she wouldn't be able to deal with it. And we were actually talking about this, and she was saying, you know, she has no idea how she would cope if she'd been taken from her children, which are the most important things to her, in the whole world, if she'd been taken for that long. It makes me feel horrible for all these families, you know, the kids that, you know, just, I don't even know what to say.
You eventually served your tour of duty in Guantanamo. You left with an honorable discharge. You received several commendations and decorations. And then you joined the Iraq Veterans Against the War. You didn't go to Iraq, but the veterans group is called Veterans Against the War. What made you do that?
Well, there were a number of reasons. I could never, after I left Guantanamo, I could never really get my head straight again. I couldn't really figure out what to do with myself. I didn't know, I just didn't know where my life was going, and I could feel all these things, just sitting around in my brain, and they weren't able to go anywhere, and I couldn't talk about it. I didn't feel like I could relate to anybody. I felt like an alien, you know, like part of the, like, what the most important, the biggest part of my memory was something that nobody in the world even knows about. And on top of that, was classified as secret, so I can't even talk about it. I signed a paper saying that I wouldn't even talk about it. So now the only thing that I wanted to talk about, I A, psychologically couldn't manage to talk about, and B, it was illegal for me to do so, and still is. I guess I just did away with that one. But I just didn't know what to do with myself. And then I found out that there was an organization of veterans, and they were the Iraq Veterans Against the War, and that they were in the business of telling the people about what we've done and telling the people about what's wrong and what, you know, like how this whole thing's a mess from the top to the bottom, and who's making money, who isn't, who's, you know, what the real thing, what the real work we're doing on the ground is, you know, beyond all the rhetoric of we need a surge, the surge is efficient or inefficient, or this is working, this isn't working, you know, these rebels are out of control here. You know, I met all these people that were you know, laying down the truth from our perspective, and it was the first time I felt like I really had a purpose since then, and it's given me a lot in my life.
Well, evidently this is a historic moment. I mean, this is the first time, this period of time, at least this tour, this two sides, one story tour, which has you speaking on platforms around the United Kingdom, the closest ally of the United States of America, with detainees who you formerly were in charge of guarding. And it's also a historic moment, of course, because today is the inauguration of Obama as the new president. That's the change that's come to your country. We have all talked about the change, and even the terminology of change has been used by the Obama campaign to really stick into the hearts of people that it's going to be different now. And one of the statements made by Obama is that I will close Guantanamo Bay. But he's also said in the past that he will surge or upsurge the numbers of troops in Afghanistan. What do you think that means, all of this, Obama's predictions for what he plans to do over the next few years of his presidency, in terms of foreign policy, not in terms of what it means for the United States internally, but in terms of his foreign policy?
It's like we've just elected like Gandalf the Wizard into our presidency or something. Like everybody's so crazy about Obama now. But from the time we went into Iraq, I knew this is a mess, and there is absolutely no reason for this. And Obama seems to be on that line as well, pulling troops out of Iraq. Awesome, total. Couldn't be happier about that. He's not going to do it fast enough. He's only pulling out, you know, a certain number of troops, and then, you know, he'll do slow pullouts, which is probably, I think, is more dangerous for us. But the increased hostilities in Afghanistan, I just can't. I don't understand. I don't understand it, because we haven't done any of the training to educate ourselves since I've started reading about your case and finding out like where everybody in Guantanamo was detained, where everything that's going on in Afghanistan. I don't think that anybody understands what's actually happening over there. I don't think anybody understands what I don't think they understand what Al-Qaeda is, what the Taliban is, where the lines are drawn, like who's our actual enemy, who's not our enemy. Nobody knows. The American population doesn't know this. But we're just going to go over there. And who's paid the price in Afghanistan? Women and kids and innocent people in houses. We've been bombing schools and just people's homes, little towns, villages for the last 7 years. When is it enough? When are we going to be done with this? When are we finally going to be able to say, all right, for whatever reason, we've said that the nation of Afghanistan is going to pay the price for everything that happened in 9/11, because one group, even if that is the case, one group is responsible for this. So we'll just carpet bomb the whole country for 7 years. And now we're going to continue. We're continuing a surge in there. I just don't understand what our goals are. I don't understand what it is, what our plan is in being in Afghanistan, and what he really plans on doing by putting more troops in there. Except putting more troops into a conflict, which we're just too tired to fight. We've been on too many deployments. we're on back-to-back-to-back rotations in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're coming home for a couple of months at a time, getting deployed again, back to the Mideast, away from our families, and to ride around in cloth-covered Humvees with no protection against an enemy we don't understand. And in Afghanistan, up in a place where the enemy has been fighting for years and years and years, is way more familiar with the terrain, way more familiar with fighting it, and has been successful at holding off a whole Russian onslaught for the last decade, and is apparently going to continue to fight us off as well. I just don't understand what his strategy is with that. And on top of that, all that means is that Bagram and Kandahar, the two major detention facilities there, are probably just going to be more well-manned and increase the capacity of those places so that we can have more detainees, most likely just because, you know, they're going to shut down the main icon of U.S. detentions, Guantanamo Bay. But once they do that, you've taken the one thing that most people from the Western world know about the global war on terror. You've taken Guantanamo Bay away, which is this kind of weird, you know, it's just this, it's like Disney World. Everybody knows about it now. You know, it's this big kind of media thing. Once you take that away, people don't know about Bagram and Kandahar. The average citizen of the UK and America and all of Europe doesn't know what those camps are and what those are there for. So detentions, illegal, awful detentions are still going to continue. So we're not addressing any of these issues.
And I think that's one of I've been contacted by the media constantly with this euphoric thing. Obama said he's going to close Guantanamo. Isn't that fantastic? And so forth. And they just don't seem to realize. I said to them, by the time I went through Bagram, I was looking forward to going to Guantanamo. That's how bad Bagram is. That's how bad the secret detention process is. That's how bad extraordinary rendition is. And people don't understand, but this is part of the work that you and I are trying to do, and that is to educate people so they do understand it, not just from my mouth, but also from yours, who saw that this war on terror through a different lens. Thank you, Chris.
No problem.